Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 4th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Children and the Christian Faith, presented by Bonnie Miller McLemore. The number is MIB2005-01. Let's listen in.
Or Josh, that's to get the video to go.
The audio.
Well, welcome. I'm really glad to see you all here. I'm Bonnie Miller McLemore, and the title of the whole series that I'm doing is Care of Children. I actually should say kids, because that's a bit more encompassing of all ages. It doesn't seem to limit you so much to children as being young. Care of Children as a Spiritual Practice. And the subtitle is how Care of Children Forms Adults. That we're not just raising children, but the children are raising us. And in fact, I don't know how many of you get zits in your newspaper, but it sort of seems like this person must live our life, because most of the humor is straight out of my own context, it seems. I have three sons, 14, 16, and 19. The 16 and 19-year-old are here. The 14-year-old and my husband couldn't be here. But one of the ones I pull out and stuck in my file that fits my subtitle reads like this. The mother is reading a note from her son. It says, "Dear Mom, all the trouble I've given you over the years has only made you a stronger person. You're welcome." Love, Jeremy. And then the father is in the final scene kind of saying, "Well, technically, I guess it does qualify as a birthday card." That is really partly my subtitle, that children and youth and kids are as much a part of forming us spiritually as adults. And those of us who care for children. The title of this session is Prayer and Parenthood, Contemplation in the Midst of Chaos. I loved hearing that read in the dining hall, because both at lunch and at dinner you could just hear this sort of quiet laughter of recognition of what family life and what living in intimate relationships it was really about. It's often quite chaotic. What I'd like to do before I kind of get into the meat of the session is make a connection to the theme of this week that I think is really a wonderful one, and let me read this passage from Exodus and see if I can tell you what I heard in it that brings this session into connection to some of what I want to do here today. And I'm just going to start with Exodus 3:2. "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked," that is Moses, "and lo, the bush was burning, and yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, 'I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt.' When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called out to him out of the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' And then he said, 'Do not come near. Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.'" It'd be nice to have all the women's names there too, but I don't have an inclusive version. I've added those. "And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God." When I thought about that theme for this summer and my own topic, right away I thought about my mom. When we moved to a new house that had no grass planted around it and was covered with mud, and I was one of three. This tells you a little bit about me and both family of origin and my current context. I was one of three, the middle of two boys, and my mom, every time we'd come in the back door, would say, "Take off your shoes!" not to get all the crud from outside, inside. It's interesting that for me, since then, I have this habit. I cannot wear shoes inside a house. And I have, I think, inadvertently, maybe not with intention, recreated that practice in my own household. I have three boys, and a dog, which I wish the dog wore shoes so I could get the dog to take off her shoes. But yeah, we take off our shoes coming into the house. One connection for me with my theme of care of children as a religious practice is to say the house is holy ground. Sacred and amazing things can happen in the household, in the mundane, in the daily, in the midst of chaos. And one other thing, this is a preview. One of my sessions is going to be about the practice of attending. And I found it really interesting in paying attention. You can't see the holy in the mundane if you're not sometimes looking for it. And I found it really interesting, if you read this passage, Moses decides, I will turn aside and see this great sight. He decides to perceive, he decides to see. I did the art walk today of seeing art objects in the midst of what would mostly be seen by people as rubbish and trash. But if you look differently, suddenly, I did have a moment like that where I'm up on the, are they called tilings?
Tailings.
I'm up in the tailings in a pile of just really, it looks like junk, and found myself looking at some really small, amazing pieces, just little tiny pieces of rusted, round and square, you know, of real beauty. But I, like Moses, had to look and then say to myself, I'm going to turn aside and see. So actually, let me pass around. I did just split these in here. Since I was mentioning a session to come, and I realized that each of these are self-contained, no one's obliged to attend all of them at all, but the one that I was just referring to is the session three, where I really am going to look at some concrete practices of reclaiming the mundane and the daily as a spiritual practice. Come on in. If you're looking for the care of children as spiritual practice, that's what this is. Let me just, before I get into the sort of meat of this session on prayer and parenthood, let me tell you a little bit about sort of how did I get into this project and what I kind of want to do with my sessions in terms of method, in fact, I want to get a lot of conversation and discussion going with you, as well as bringing some ideas that I've had on this project. I've been thinking about children and families and parenthood and work and family for a long time. And in fact, probably most of you missed this, but we originally posted sessions from a prior book that I did called Let the Children Come, Reimagining Childhood from a Christian Perspective. And I would love to talk more about that particular text. And some of that is shaping what I'm working on and will be sharing with you here. But the subtitle of that text really is the heart of it. It was an effort to rethink children as full human beings and very much a part of normal, of life, instead of children as innocent or romanticized in some other way. And prior to that, I have another text. Both of these books, I brought copies. They're both in the bookstore. Again, of great interest that they're going to shape what I do this week, but they're not the heart of what I'm doing. But prior to that, I did a book called Also a Mother, Work and Family as Theological Dilemma. even though the title makes it sound as if it's a book on motherhood, it's really a book on the complexities of adulthood in contemporary society, with the ways in which we get so stretched and caught between ideals of work and ideals of family that we're trying to live up to, various ways we've been formed and socialized. And so both of those projects have led me into the current one. And I'm going to pass out also a second handout that kind of shows you where I am in this current project. It has currently the same book title that I'm using for these sessions, but I have a feeling that that may get reshaped quite a bit. Jossie Bass is the publisher, and they're really good at trying to get you to write for a wider audience, and they'll help me maybe with the catchier title. I have no idea, but I thought it would help you to see the larger project, and you'll see that several of the sessions I'm doing are just attempts to get at some of the chapters that I'm working on, and I'm at various stages in working on them. And it was hard even to decide which of the various practices should I share with you here. And again, I'm happy to talk outside of this about some of the other chapters I'm not going to do here, and any thoughts or interest that you might have to help me. It is a work in progress, and I almost see this as a wonderful opportunity. Dorothy Bass is a great friend of mine, and several weeks ago when I decided to shift to do what I'm working on, I thought, well, I wonder if she tricked me into this, because this book that I'm working on is going to be in a series that she's been editing and largely responsible. She also has a book in the series. It's a book called Practicing Our Faith. Some of you may have heard of it. It's an edited book that has several practices: keeping the Sabbath, honoring the body, dying well, singing, that we don't think of as religious practices. We usually think of prayer, we usually think of reading scripture, but it's an attempt to reclaim some of the other mundane but daily ways in which we live together and embody our faith. And there are other books in that series, and this one will be one that will be sort of on the practices of family life. So that tells you a little bit about how I'm doing is here fits into some of my other thoughts and work, and really it's an invitation to get conversation going with you. What do I want to do today? What I'd like to do today is just a really small piece of that to provoke your thoughts. And the slice I want to look at is and each day I'm just going to sort of have a thematic question. And I am going to share some thoughts on that. Please, if you have, as I'm doing that and have a thought, don't hesitate to interrupt me. And then I really would like to, this is a small enough group where I don't think you need to go into sub-dyads or triads, just to spend a good portion of the rest of the time hearing some of your thoughts and reactions and insights as you've listened. And I actually, one thing I did that I'm going to pass around, take a card if you want. There are pencils if you don't have a pencil. If you have a thought while you're sitting here that just comes to mind, I'd like you to jot it down. And if you want to leave the card with me, I would be, if it's something you didn't get a chance to say, I'd love to have your thought, your question, your observation. It's just, again, another way. Sometimes it's hard to get things. An hour is a very short time. So what's my question for today? Here are some things. Good. Welcome. The question that I'm looking at today is, does anybody else need pencils? Anybody else? Is how do we, I listed it here. How does one pray in the midst of the demands and distractions, the busy work of our busy work and family lives? In some ways, this question, even though I'm focusing it very much around the care of children, I think it's a question all of us face. It may be a question that's a bit more dire within family lives. And I'm going to try to do three things in this sort of introductory comments. One is to highlight how the Christian tradition has, from my perspective, misunderstood or at times misrepresented prayer in a way that makes it almost antithetical or antagonistic to family life. The second thing I want to do is read you a bit from a draft that tells just one moment, but maybe for me a more memorable moment, of sort of awakening that this model of Christian prayer did not fit my own immediate experience within a family context. And then finally, just offer the glimmer of another model of thinking about prayer. And in a way, this is pretty condensed. My next session will say, I'm not the first person to think of this. So Wednesday, I'm going to give you a taste of some other people in the tradition. And in fact, I'm going to start with Luther. I'm not Lutheran. I'm Christian Church Disciples of Christ, a small denomination, American-born denomination. But Luther, those of you who are Lutheran should know, is someone who did attempt in a really radical way to reclaim mundane life as prayer-filled. And I want to say we've lost a bit of what Luther, I think, claimed. So let me start back with what's the problem in the Christian tradition? When people think of prayer, they automatically picture silence. And in fact, when we're asked to pray in a corporate setting, we are usually asked, and it's a posture we usually adopt, to bow our heads and close our eyes. And the reason for that, there are many good reasons why prayer is connected with that posture. I was recently at a meeting where the person who was leading a corporate prayer before a meal invited us to look around and see who was in the room and give thanks as we looked to see the friendships, the colleagues, the relationships with which we were bound. And for me, that was a metaphor of what I'm trying to say. And I'm not trying to rule out silence, but I want to say there may be room for other ways of thinking. When people picture parenting, they see the opposite. They really do, I think, accurately see noise, complication, from the young to the old, age, dirty diapers, sleepless nights, phone calls from teachers, endless to-do lists, rooms strewn with stuff, car rides, pandemonium. By and large, both of these portraits are accurate. Prayer does require focused attention, and caring for children is perhaps, I think, one of the most distracting, disorienting, intrusive things we try to do with our lives. Is there room for prayer in the midst of this down-to-earth demand? The Western tradition has largely said no. And partly that is a history that is shaped by the very early beginnings of the Christian tradition, influenced by the early Greek culture that saw material life as over against and a problem for the spiritual life. The early patristic fathers of the Christian tradition, very influenced by this Greek view, were sympathetic to marriage. And in fact, some of them saw the obligation to marry as an important part of the Christian tradition. But they never saw it as an equal path to God, as the monastic path of celibacy. So you find treatises on the virtues of virginity that include an amazing list of negative comments, all of them quite accurate, actually. Here's the list in one of the church fathers. The risks and discomforts of infertility, pregnancy and childbirth, the drudgery of domestic work, fights and violence. They mention all these things. Anxiety about infidelity, servants, and the death of family members. For these early church theologians, they might disagree with each other about the place of the family life in the Christian faith, but they all saw family life as inferior to celibacy. Now, we may not think, one of these church fathers, Gregory, makes this remark, if these folks, that is, people who go into families, could only learn about its hardships prior, they would, quote, "What a crowd of deserters would run from marriage." Now, it's funny because I don't think many people today would flock that in this way to celibacy, but I want to say this legacy of prayer continues to shape us. Several years ago, I was at a meeting on Christian faith practices, and it was very interesting that a well-regarded systematic theologian at the meeting made this offhanded remark that on the birth of her first child, the discipline of prayer had become impossible. And I understood what she meant, but I also had this sense of there's something drastically wrong with that perception. But I think her view really is a common one. Another story that embodies this, several years before my husband and I had children, we led a prayer group using Harry Emerson Fosdick's book, The Meaning of Prayer. And this book is designed around daily readings, which really suggests that everyone in the group should set aside a special time for prayer. What was interesting and powerfully formative for us at this time was that most of the adults in the class really struggled. And most of them had kids. And repeatedly, with some guilt, they expressed their sort of desire to do this, but their attempts had failed. They were too tired in the morning, they were too tired at night, and they were too overwhelmed in the hours between. And it's for me to think back, without kids, we sort of press these good church folk to persist. Now we really, we've talked about this, and we look back and laugh a bit at our own sort of slightly pretentious naivete, like, well, we could at least find some time to pray. What's, you know, wrong with this group? Again, I think what I'm trying to say is that these folks were trying to adapt a deeply embedded pattern of prayer with an incompatible pattern of their own material life with children and feeling guilty at their lack of success. Wendy Wright is a wonderful Catholic author. Let me just parenthetically say Catholic. But it's interesting, there are some good books out there by Protestants. But my overall sense is that the more common author is the Catholic author. And yet, again, with Luther, this is ours to reclaim. Wendy Wright is a Catholic author who has written some wonderful books on family and spirituality. And she actually, there are several people that fed me as I struggle with these issues, and she is one. And I came across this quote of hers. Few of the great remembered prayers of our tradition were married. Few had children. Again, Luther is a turning point. It's nice to be here to lift that up for those of you who are in that tradition. But that's not all. She names several other factors that are just at odds with most of our lives. They pursued God through silence and solitude, and I'm going to come back to that. And they pursued it through mobility of an unattached life. So they sought to love all dispassionately. Again, that's something very hard if you're passionately in love with intimate others. They radically cut ties with families, and they resisted matrimony. Reaching God meant transcending the body, voluntary poverty, and pilgrimage out of the home to other places. Wendy Wright, and I think as you, those of you who are embedded in relationships, recognize there's a big dissonance between this description and our reality of of partnership, relationship, marriage, children, paid employment. That's, we have passionate attachment to particular others. We are immersed in the bodily. And in fact, part of my argument will be that the bodily itself is amazingly and richly spiritual, like something the Christian tradition has just struggled with. But if you're a parent and you've been so close to others, you realize it's so immensely tactile, bodily. These people are we're committed to one location. We're not able to pilgrim a lot. In fact, it isn't until my kids are this teenage stage that we can sort of split up and go different directions as a family vacation. I think, you know, in some ways that would have been very difficult. If my children were younger. We're immersed in the bodily. We have ownership. We have to care for material possessions. And we have to maintain homes. So let me give you one last example before making my second move of what was my moment of awakening, which I think you're already getting sort of foreshadows of. The last little piece of example, not too many years ago, it was when I had begun to think about this project. I was sort of flipping through the newspaper, and there was an article on centering prayer. Some of you may have heard of Thomas Keating, again a Catholic monk. I don't object to centering prayer, but listen to this newspaper's description of it. It read, "The search for God starts by entering a room, the private inner room of the soul. There a person finds God waiting beyond the noise, beeps, and defeats of life outside." Unquote. Each one of those words I want to challenge. Does God, is he, she, situated in such an interior, private, inside space? And what does that do to the outside? What does it do to the beeps and the demands of most of our lives? The Christian perception of prayer is something outside ordinary time, or maybe within the formal religious institutions, is something I think, again, that still pervades Western society. So let me, step two. What was just a piece of a moment of awakening for me? I think in telling this, I'm also thinking, maybe you've had these glimmers that you haven't trusted as good, faithful intuitions of your own that you might think of and trust. And one other digression I wanted to, as I thought about this title, Contemplation in the Midst of Chaos, this is a wonderful setting for me to be thinking about this.
So chaotic.
Yeah. Because of its intergenerational nature. And so we were sitting at the table tonight, and there was maybe a 1.5 or 1-year-old next to us, just screaming in the middle of your announcements and turning the glass upside down. The water was going everywhere. And my kids are older now. Was that yours?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But it's so wonderful to see how richly, the rich potential of parenting and this intergenerational setting in which I see older children parenting. And I'm really trying to use parenting in a very open sense to non-biological care of children. It's all of our responsibility. But I'm also watching older children here care for younger children, not when they're volunteering in Narnia, but all in lots of places all over the village. So this has been a wonderful setting for me to keep thinking about these. But my moment came, I had many moments of awakening, but this probably is one that was pivotal. And it was a quintessential act of multitasking. I had two young children that were taking a tub, and I was sort of trying to get my reading done for class while I sat on the bath, the toilet watching them. And I had assigned Henry Nouwen's book, which is a wonderful book, This is not to totally undercut the book, but it is a critique. The way of the heart, and where he tries to retrieve the desert fathers. But it was astounding to sit there reading. He's drawing on one of the Abba fathers, Arsenius, and he organizes the entire book around solitude, silence, and prayer. These are the three means to the love of God. Flee, be silent, and pray. The words flee, quote, be silent, and pray summarize the spirituality of the desert. These are the sources of sinlessness, says Arsenius. Unquote. And there is some truth here. Solitude does free us from this compulsive conformity to the world. It moves us, it can move us towards compassion. It can reorient our lives and our hearts. And solitude and silence can be a step to prayer. But I sat there and thought to myself, yes, as I've written here, no doubt there were times when I wanted to flee motherhood. No doubt there were times when I yearned for silence. Or when they came, I was often too spent to appreciate them. But as my young son babbled with words and drew me out of my reading, another thought crystallized. Were silence and solitude, while essential and necessary, sufficient unto themselves? I looked up and realized the danger, now one talks about the danger of wordiness. To witness one of my sons, not much over a year, play with words, and how words were for him a source of knowledge, a source of new power, of relationship, of meaning, that they allowed him to begin to build a world. And although certainly, again, words lead to sin, which is the Desert Fathers view, and silence, quote, again, by the Desert Fathers, leads us, keeps us pilgrims, I found myself thinking that the reverse, that silence could be oppressive and unhelpful for all of us, and that words can build a home. And I think it's important to say I didn't then, and I'm not now trying to rule out silence and solitude. In fact, as I've been thinking about this, I actually chose a job that has built in silence and solitude, the profession of teaching. And I think I like a large amount of both. As I was writing this book, my husband and I share a study, and he hadn't really made as much use of it as I have. You try to do that too. And so he's in there. Tap, 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 tap. I mean, tapping, that's not even hardly a noise. And I finally have to go, will you please take your PowerPoint computer or your laptop and, you know, move out. So there is an importance for silence and solitude. I simply want to widen the circle. Okay, so step three, and then let me just stop it and hear some of your thinking. Widening the circle of prayer, what does this mean? I think it's risky. I think we know that chaos, if we go back to the word and the reality, it's not always so promising. And we do have good reasons for wanting to get away from it. Widening the circle of prayer, I think, means a really difficult balance between silence and words, solitude and company. That may be different for each of us and where we fall on this. In fact, as I was working on this, I was reading a book by a friend of mine on a similar topic of spirituality and family life, and both objected and understood that to write it, he left his family and went to a retreat home. And I thought, is that kind of, you know, how is he, but for him, that may be where his balance point fell for his ability to sustain prayer in relationship to family life. I had a metaphor that arose while I was working on this. My oldest son, he's 19, real outdoors person, I took a break and followed him outside because he had tied up something called a slack line. Do you know what a slap line is? I bet most of you don't. Yeah, the teenage people know this. It's great. It was a flat. It's a flat, brilliant red in his case rope, and you tie it between two trees. And you got to get it just right so it's got enough tension it doesn't give when you get on it, and then you walk on it. It's sort of like the tightrope idea. Well, it looked really easy. You know, he gets up there, and I'm thinking, okay, could I try this? I couldn't even take a step. It was really hard. And he basically, I think he's told me, I haven't watched him do this, but now he can walk across it, and he was working on turning around, which, again, sounds really simple, but it's not. Muscles matter, but it's not all muscle. I think holding the tension between silence and words, solitude and company, is a lot like this. It's hard to sustain. This is why the tradition has jumped off the slack line and said, let's just go with silence and solitude. Staying on the slack line is really hard. I think one way that we've also tried to stay on the slack line is, and these are helpful, and may be helpful to some of your own thinking, is to come up with ways that we can pray in the midst of chaos. So I've bumped into very helpful, it's not fair to reduce them, but let me just, for the sake of talking here, techniques for prayer. One is Brother Lawrence, who talks about the habit of sensing God's presence throughout the day, regardless of your circumstances. Practicing the presence is the phrase that we often hear used in drawing on Brother Lawrence and his tradition. He was a Catholic monk, or not a monk, he was a lay brother in the Carmelite order, meaning that he had a lot of, you know, arduous, drudgerous work that he did. And in the time that he would be in the kitchen, for example, he would say, I possess God as tranquilly as if I were upon my knees in prayer. And I think this is very helpful. And in fact, as I've read some about Brother Lawrence, I realize that those persons who are often in the African American tradition have a similar concept. They use the phrase tarrying, T-A-R-R-Y, I'm not pronouncing that right, I-N-G, in worship, where you stay in worship repeating words over and over of praise, thanksgiving, and confession. And I think many persons formed within this worship tradition carry that practice into life of constant conversation throughout the day. One other technique that some authors have written about that is helpful when you think about family life is the breath prayer, which is a single line prayer that adapts an ancient form of repetition, very much around breathing, Jesus is Lord, or what tailored often to your own tradition or a particular phrase that is of meaning to you. These are all helpful, but they're not exactly what I'm trying to get at. I still think that these sometimes ask of us a focus of mind and of will and heart that we can't always muster in the chaos of our family lives. I want to redeem the routine itself, which I think is partly why people have been responsive to Brother Lawrence's idea, is that they hear in what he's doing a sense of suggesting that our actions themselves can be prayer, the routine themselves. I'm wanting to say that we can practice the presence of God not just through a prayer discipline, but throughout the day through particular kinds of daily practices that invoke, that evoke, that form faith, much like the one I pointed to right at the very beginning, of just the practice of attending, of seeing, of perception. The phrase I've used in the session that's to come is pondering all these things, which comes straight out of the Luke passages about Mary, and my sense that Mary was indeed in deep prayer in a very different way than we traditionally think of it, in the midst of the very obvious, we must have been chaotic birth and reception of guests in the stable. So I guess my final sort of comment here, I want to say that for those of us who struggle with prayer in this more conventional sense, there's nothing wrong with those of us who pray, who struggle. There's something wrong with the definition of prayer that has sort of precluded what we're doing in our family lives. And there's a need to consider alternative ways to think about the practice of faith in the midst of life. The Western history has had a long tradition of saying no to prayer in the midst of families. I want to say there are wonderful resources for saying yes to a different way of thinking about it. I've just talked and talked and talked. We've got about 15 more minutes. I've got the time right. And would love to just get you thinking. Some of the questions that I'm wondering is, what do you think about this? Does it fit some of your own experience? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Do you have other thoughts that were sparked for you as you thought about some of these issues of faith and family or faith and relationships?
It does seem like the chaos in our lives, when you kind of take what you're talking about, balance with the work-family dilemma or argument, balancing work and life, that there's, in the context of what you're talking about, still room for eliminating some of the chaos in our life. You know, we have it, but last week we had a session on the overindulged child and how we fill our lives with things that are really, really too much. Maybe that's some of the sessions coming up that you have, but the multiple lessons throughout the week and things to do that are really Western pressures to produce and to be a certain way as a family.
I think that no matter how simple one chooses to live, if there are children, it's chaotic. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the reality. And if you can just miss out on so much if you just are always waiting for the right time or waiting for the luxury of silence. And you can end up focusing so much on not joy, that child or those children.
I really like your idea with the problem with the word prayer. It reminds me of a lecture I had seen, lecture slash presentation of some African musicians, and he was saying, and I apologize, I don't remember which country, but he was saying in the language there isn't even a word for music because it's just a part of their life. They can't even like say to someone, well, did you play some music? He said there is no word, music. And to pray, you just get these images of that, you know, painting my grandma had at her table of, you know, the guy sitting at his table with some fish or...
It's a grand wood, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's, you know, if you define it so narrowly as prayer, I mean, when this man said that there was no word for music, it was so opening, you know, like, wow, that's just like part of your life, you know. You do it all the time. You just start and stop and start and stop. And so I like that idea that you have.
A couple quick responses, and then I'm going to, maybe it'll feed
some other things people are thinking about. I would underscore Western. I think some of what I am getting at is a very Western, and perhaps, and maybe I alluded to this in talking a bit about the African American, a very European American problem. I don't want to say that completely, because I think it probably goes across some ethnic groups and some class groups, but I do think the Western piece, we have inherited a fairly narrow and often dualistic sacred and secular. The sacred is in church, the secular is, you know, and even though we may not think that we're agreeing with that, it's very hard, it's very deeply ingrained in our cultural context, or the dominant cultural context of the U.S. And so I think when you're saying African and music, I think that that's a very nice picture. Well, and let me just pick up, don't lose your thought, that I think I was thinking of both of your comments. What's interesting for me, I may come back to this when I talk a bit about how do we deal with what I'm calling session four, playing the field, Xbox, soccer, and the other fun family games. There I'm going to sort of deal a little bit with technology, and I'm going to try to walk this very fine line between both rejecting culture and technology and living with it, which I think Reinhold Niebuhr, or H. Richard Niebuhr, his brother, does a wonderful job in his book on Christ and culture, where he talks about the different ways you can live with culture. And one response is over against culture. It's seen as a sort of sectarian, fleeing culture. And that, to be honest, sometimes that is my reaction. And I saw, driving between my family home in Bloomington back to Nashville, Tennessee, where I live, there are many Amish communities. And I pass those communities and think, you know, that looks pretty darn good. But maybe not. I mean, so my place with back to H. Richard Niebuhr's metaphor is not Christ against culture, but and I think it's perhaps the most idealistic position, but Christ transforming culture, living in culture, but not of it. And so that's the very fine tension to walk between how much chaos is too much and is too much culturally imposed upon us, and we should simply say, no, I'm not going to do these 25 things, and how much is impossible not to go back. We can't romanticize and leave culture. We are living in the 21st century. We have to live with some of what is part of contemporary pressure. So it's maybe back to the slack line. It's another one of the slack lines that at least in my tradition, in my place in the Christian tradition, where I'm situated. But I think those are really helpful points, particularly we could talk more about the way we're indulging in some ways in family life in an unhealthy way. The indulged child, that phrase that you used, is a very powerful and problematic one. And I think for the Christian tradition too, because we're called to love all children, not just ours. And so that indulged child, I think, is a reprimand to those of us who proclaim our Christian commitment to parent all of the children in our spheres, not just ours with the best schools, the best lessons, the best, you know. And I think that, in my Let the Children Come book, that may be one of the things I didn't realize I was going to argue against, but it kept coming up. As a case I felt like needed to be made. So that argument I really do make there. But you had a thought.
I was just thinking about the Western, the way you talked about Western tradition, at least the dominant part of Western tradition that locks us into this sacred and secular. And one of the non-Western ways is so obvious is the Old Testament Jewish Hebrew tradition that doesn't separate the physical and the spiritual the way the Greek and Roman thinking did. And that's simplistic, but I think it's a much needed resource for us.
That's very helpful, because I do think that the Jewish tradition
has a very different kind of attitude towards the material life, towards flesh, even towards sexuality. That there is a Jewish, we need rabbi, Marx here, is it a mitzvah, obligation? You know, you have sex on Friday night, that's the Sabbath. You know, that the Christian tradition, because of the Greek influence, began to really suspect the embodiment of our sexual desires as a turn away from God, in Augustine's words, for example. And that's been read back a bit into Paul. It's hard to know how Greek Paul became, but if you look at some of the Hebrew texts, I think you're right, the materiality of God's embeddedness in the lives of the Hebrew people. And I've seen somewhere a similar argument about Jesus. And I can't remember where and what the case was, because I remember having a dialogue with what I was reading, because you do have Jesus going to the wilderness and desert to pray. But this person was trying to make the same case that Jesus sustained that Jewish influence of seeing his ministry as very much in the midst of poverty, in the midst of chaos, very much in this way. So, other thoughts?
I was just thinking about our own culture here, maybe just in the United States, versus another culture. I was thinking of Mexico, I was thinking of Greece, actually, where children are welcome everywhere. That is not the case in this country, I don't think. I think children are, let's get rid of them, okay? We don't really want to see them around this restaurant, or we don't want them, you know, this is an adult thing. This is a kid thing. We separate them all the time, and I feel like if you've been to those cultures where kids are a thriving part, some of the people don't seem as stressed. Some of them have the same, you know, chaos, but I feel like children aren't welcome everywhere in this culture.
We've had different kinds of, related to that at Holden, different people ask for some separation at worship, you know, for the kids over there. And I think one of the things that Holden tries to model is that we're all in it together, you know, and that small children are welcome at the mill, you know, and at worship. It's just part of it. And we've even had parents come and say, My kid can't, you know, doesn't want to go to church every day. Or recently we saw, I think they're gone from the village now, but two children with Game Boys during prayer around the cross. You know, and how does the community contain that? How do we work with that?
There was a time when it was harder to have a two-year-old. I mean, he was two the first time he came up here. And it was still kind of harder at Holden to have a little one. But it's come miles and miles of scrape. That intergenerational thing you were touching on too.
And I don't want, you know, Janet or any of the staff to perceive this as a negative or a critique, but there are also parents who, we've been here a month now, and there are a multitude of ways that it's not child friendly. But that's the ebb and flow of, you know, that there aren't staff with very tiny children, and so you know, you just
they're coming,
you know, we've got 7 years difference between this baby and our other, and you know, our house had become not, and still is not, child friendly. You know, in the way that it was when we had two infants in the house, and so you know, that's just an ebb and flow. And we've had many who've said that there have been times when it's been just amazingly more child or young family doable than this has been tough. Mm-hmm. But it's been great too. Mm-hmm. So.
I just sort of reinforce what you're saying. I am amazed how much openness there is to the presence of children. And it's interesting to hear you say that it's a generational shift even, because I do think it is sort of, some people have argued that it is sort of the next front of, if you still use this old word, of liberation, inclusivity, of respect, of honoring children in a fuller way that we're struggling with as a culture. And I think we, as a Western culture, we have tended to age segregate across the line in a very unhelpful and unhealthy way. And the kind of feeling of, well, it's interesting, when I see it, one of the best places to see it is maybe churches for sure, and worship, where you see people like, I'm being bothered. But the other places are restaurants and airplanes. So flying out here, I flew Southwest, where you just kind of herd on and fight for your seat. There's a row of three seats open. Great. We sit down, and I realize, oh, I see why it's open. There's kids right in front. Little kids. Nobody wants to sit near them. And, you know, and I sat, actually, they were, for the most part, if you've been a parent, you, I think you get over that, or maybe some of these folks are parents that want to get away from it. But I actually wasn't bothered at all. And I was impressed how, you know, well, this kid did scream. This was a child who screamed himself to sleep. And I almost want to ask the parents later, does he always do that? Or is that just, because they, I could tell, it didn't seem like unusual to them. They had to rock the child screaming. And you could tell he was just so tired, that was how he went to sleep. But, you know, I think planes and restaurants are the place where that antagonism against children. So I think this is a really important step Holman is trying to represent. Mm-hmm. There, I see somebody back there, and then Janet, and then Ingrid, Janet, and then back here to Brenda.
I just want to say that most of my, I work in Chicago, and my I work with people facing the death penalty, and I spend a lot of time with their families. And their people in those, in that situation are almost universally very poor, black, white, Latino. And the children are not separated from the adults. They go everywhere together. And they have almost no common space in most of their homes. It's so crowded. And it's, there are beds everywhere. And the suffering of those children is just immeasurable. And it's invisible to us. It's invisible to us as a culture. People, I keep thinking, what do you mean we cherish children? What do you mean we care about, you know? Those children, and if you go to poor schools, you see the suffering, you see the children are abused, and they're miserable, and they're needy, and they're fed poorly, and they're, I mean, all of my clients who are people facing the death penalty, who've all done horrendous things, have had terrible nutrition all their lives. You know, I have one client who spent a year and a half eating nothing but peanut M&Ms. You know, I mean, we don't care about children in this country. I'm sorry, we might care about our own middle class kids, but we do not care about the poor. It is abundantly clear to me. In public policy, and these kids are thrown on the scrap heap.
One of the things I was going to say, I forgot, that one of the issues of many, one of the many issues that shapes this problem is statistically, as a culture, if you just take the statistics, and I'm not going to get these exactly right, but we have become top-heavy on adults without children. So they're, compared to several decades ago, the percentage of adults that lived and worked with children was quite greater than it is today. So I think this is going to be an ongoing issue. The farther we have adults removed from immediate impact with children, the more likely, the more difficult it is to be an advocate for children beyond one's own or in general. So, I mean, some of the things that I would see written about this are the creation of dog parks. You know,
yes. Yeah.
As a good example.
Dog parks.
Instead of parks for children. Because, you know, people don't have children. They have
dog daycare.
So I think that's an example of where, and I think you're also getting at some of the class issues that really are operative here.
Well, it's public policy.
But do we have to go? Were there two people still? Janet Quick and Freda Quick, and then we'll quit.
I was just going to say that about 8 or 9 years ago, we started doing prayer around the cross every Friday night, which is a dark service with candlelight and very quiet. And we had some very young children in the village at the time, 1 and 2 years old, and some 4 and 5 year olds. And so we decided to have, it would be in the wintertime, it would be in here. We decided to have childcare in that room because we surely those children couldn't deal with it. They dealt with it better than the adults. They loved the quiet service. They loved coming forward. They loved the light. And they would come to light their candle. And they learned to pray.
My children love that service the best. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they love many of them. But we get to play with fire.
Right.
We get to pray with fire.
I guess one thing I'm not doing with what I'm doing here, but is, and I don't want to trivialize, romanticize, idealize, but how much we can learn from children.
Oh, right.
How deeply we have underestimated their intelligence, their ability to participate at all ages. So that's another just premise that I'm not building in this particular session, but that you're getting
in
at.
In my class today, a woman made a comment about how, what are we doing to our children? Because when you see your children, the children of society coming out of younger grades, schools, how happy they are. But then when you see the children coming out of high schools, how sad and angry and mad they all are. And who wants to be around that? And just was really dismissive. And I teach high school. And I teach in a Jesuit high school. And it's a phenomenal place to teach, but I would have to say that those children are dismissed as much for many other reasons. You know, I have students that are left there from 6:30 in the morning and don't go home until 7:30, 8:30 at night because there's nobody there.
Yeah.
You know, the parents are farming them out somewhere else. So, but and just that the silent, just adults that silence children, I have a real hard time with that. Or that they label them immediately like that because of, you know, and she was making comments about their clothes and their baggy pants and, you know, all the wonderful looks that they liked to do and how angry they are. And I wanted to say,
I've been really, again, in a piece of this work on rethinking kids and children is to be very careful about how we have characterized teenagers.
Yeah.
And the way we have truncated the complexity of their lives that aren't that far removed from lives of little children and our own adults, so-called adult lives. And that's really a disservice. So I'm really with you there. And the other thing I'd say is the leaving children at school for a long time, unfortunately, our adult public policies and world, I found this out as a parent, are structured as so over against the child schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at the kind of holidays that occur with no sense of the way it doesn't work out with a typical work life. And I have a very flexible job compared to working parents who do not. So I think that's another huge public policy issue, but we need to stop. I loved your comments. I'm really glad you're here. Have a good rest of the week.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, and if you have written anything on any card, I'd love to have it. If it's blank, I'll take it back.
Teaching in chaos, I teach living.